You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
Let's have Allison Williams in every week. What do you say?
Well, I mean,
we have her in multiple times, but we'll schedule.
She's got to be one of the best bank analyst, international bank analyst in the world, and she works for us.
Yes.
So that's a bonus. Plus, she loves talking about Credit Suisse. There is no one who prefers talking about Credit Suisse more than Allison Williams.
All right, Allison, we had a bit just more going on. We've got a million ways we can go. As Matt was saying, let's start with Credit Suisse. Is it going to survive the weekend?
Well, it's going to be tough. We think that, you know, for sure, and regulators have said that they're closely monitoring the situation. They have to be in discussions with the bank. I think that the moves that we saw this week were meant to steady sentiment and assure investors. The stock is telling us today that hasn't necessarily helped. I think that there's two things. One is the liquidity and soundness of the bank, and I think that the SNB coming out and saying Swiss National Bank, we have to differentiate because they also have the shareholder SNB. But, you know,
that's the Saudi National Bank.
Yes. So they borrowed the $54 billion or said they were going to borrow the $54 billion Credit Suisse from the government. The government has said, or the regulator has said, you know, they are there. They're there to backstop the liquidity. But, you know, to us, the issue with Credit Suisse is, you know, you have to study the confidence, you have to study the flows, you have to, because that really is their core business. And the move was meant to study client sentiment. The investor sentiment is telling you that they're not assured.
I mean, there's so many ways we could go with this. First of all, when someone asks you if you're going to increase your investment in a bank in which you already own 10%, don't say absolutely not. Don't be vehement about the fact that you're never going to give this bank any more money again, because that's a bad idea. I guess the most important questions, though, Allison, are why would you work for this bank? I mean, clearly, it's because you can't get a job somewhere else. Why would you have your money at this bank? Do you really trust that it's going to continue? And then why would you trade with this bank? There are already very important large national banks that are cutting that relationship off. So I can't imagine how it goes on in anything like the same form.
Well, let's start with your last point with regard to
BNP
trading and counterparty risk, because I think that's the issue that we've probably gotten the most questions from investors about this week. And we certainly saw, to your point, when their largest investor said that they weren't going to add additional investments, that you started to see that in the stocks of some of the biggest U.S. banks. But when we look at that, you know, the two things that we think about are, one, this isn't a new situation. It's been a couple of years, and, you know, we would expect that the counterparty risk management departments of these banks have been managing down their exposures accordingly. And then secondly, if we look at the trading operations, which is something that we've discussed, I mean, they're a shadow of their former self. And that also tells you just that their activity with banks globally has slowed a bit on that front. So certainly there are still relationships out there, we would expect, but that those exposures have been managed down in terms of a counterparty. I would liken it to if we look back to what happened with Bear Stearns and Lehman. I think, you know, counterparties with Lehman were sort of on high alert, beginning with Bear Stearns, which happened actually this month several years ago. But by the time, you know, when Lehman eventually went under, the issues really related to, you know, money markets that held investment in Lehman. It was less about sort of remaining counterparty risk.
Yeah, that's kind of what we learned. Boy, just as even as a neophyte, boy, if you lose confidence in the marketplace and counterparty risk comes into play, it's almost game over. Allison, on Credit Suisse, is there anything more the government can do, really? I'm not even sure how to map out a scenario, you know, where this thing kind of survives. I don't know.
Do they take control of the bank?
Exactly.
Can they force a sale to UBS? By the way, we'll discourage the use of the word merger because there's no way anybody's coming together with Credit Suisse as an equal partner.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think that, you know, when we think about the government, I mean, and it's been very interesting just seeing what's happening both in the U.S. and in Europe as the government is trying to assure investors, and certainly the size and nature of Credit Suisse is not comparable to the banks that failed in the U.S. or First Republic, which investors are also worried about. But the connection is market sentiment, and you have, you know, regulators in both of these countries trying to, you know, stabilize sentiment at the specific bank, but then also more broadly. And, you know, as measures don't work, you have to try different things. I think when we think about Credit Suisse, you know, for years people have talked about it as, you know, as you said, a merger partner. Now it's, you know, more of a takeout candidate. What exactly happens? I think when we think about, you know, what the bank looked like today versus a couple of years ago, again, their trading operations have a shadow of their former self. The Swiss bank unit is what the Swiss government is going to want to protect. And then we have the wealth business, which I think, you know, a lot of people will think is a great fit with UBS. But what we've seen with UBS is they're taking a lot of those flows without the combination. So I think it circles back to your earlier point. It, you know, is what will regulators do in terms of forcing the issue or trying to help, you know, some kind of combination that can protect the Swiss unit, and really that's the unit that's important to their economy and the system that they oversee.
All right, Allison, thank you as always for helping out here. Allison Williams, Senior Global Banks and Asset Manager for Bloomberg Intelligence. And not only that, she was recently promoted to be Co-Director of Research for the Americas for Bloomberg Intelligence. So she's got to now manage, along with her partner, you know, more than 150 analysts, which is like herding cats. I mean, these people
seems like a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, but she's up to it, and she does a great job. She's got great experience on Wall Street, and she's been indispensable here as we try to figure out what's going on in the banking space, not just in the U.S., but overseas as well, focusing really on Credit Suisse.
You're listening to The Team, Cantor Live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app, or listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
We actually know a couple people in the rates business. Erica Edelberg, she covers the mortgage-backed security business for Bloomberg Intelligence. She joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, so a double gold star for being in the studio on a Friday. And Ira Jersey, he's a U.S. interest rate strategist. I'm just going to guess he's mailing it in from home. But so, Erica, since you're here, we're going to go with you first. We may not even talk to Ira, you know. So in this bank, quote, I'm not going to call it a crisis, although many people do.
John Authors has said, don't call it a crisis yet.
I'm with John. Yeah. I'm with John. But there's turmoil. Does that mean banks pull back? Can I not get my jumbo mortgage for the Matt Miller estate up in Westchester? I mean, what are we seeing in the mortgage market?
Yeah, we are actually seeing, according to the data that I've seen, banks pulling back on credit, and that was before this latest turmoil, as we're calling it now. The Mortgage Credit Availability Index that the MBA tracks, which is dependent on a mix of variables, is at decade lows. So that could make it harder. The one sector
that's interesting. By the way, that's fascinating. So even as I look at the bank rate, 30-year mortgage index, just as my benchmark, and it has come down. It bounced back up in the last couple of days. But even if that rate is lower, mortgages still may not be available. Banks may not be giving out loans, even if you could get them for cheaper.
It definitely could tighten credit, yeah. And I think this latest turmoil is going to make that even more of an issue. That being said, the jumbo credit index actually is the one sector that hasn't fallen quite as much as Fannie, Freddie, Ginnie, you know, standard conventional mortgages. And I think that's partly because, for better or for worse, that is already a very high credit product. And the larger loans are more attractive for banks to originate and a lot of times hold on their balance sheets. So, and a lot of those are actually in adjustable rate mortgages, which do have a better asset liability mix with the bank's balance sheet.
But bottom line, financial conditions have tightened substantially since the failure of SVB. Ira Jersey, is that going to make a difference to our Federal Reserve? It's ours, yours, mine, and Ira's, Paul.
Okay.
Is that going to make a difference to our Federal Reserve when they meet to decide whether or not to raise rates?
Yeah, it absolutely will. I think in part because the Fed is worried about the financial sector and some of the knock-on effects that you could have if you have additional bank failures and credit tightening even more. That being said, I still think that, you know, with some of the lending facilities that they've used, there's a lot of people worrying about the fact that the discount window is over $150 billion in usage. It's probably just from a couple of institutions. They're worried that is a signal that there might be wider systemic risk. But I think that what the Fed will do here is say, look, we're gonna hike 25 basis points because inflation's still a problem, but we're also going to continue to have liquidity facilities as needed and encourage banks to use the existing liquidity facilities in order to stop any runs on additional banks that might have some liquidity issues.
Well, they sure are doing that. You don't need to encourage them, right? They've already used the discount window like 40% more than they did at the height of the great financial crisis.
Yeah, and I think that one of the issues that the Fed had at the height of the financial crisis, or even at the very beginning, was trying to convince institutions to use some of the existing facilities. So they created all of these other, you know, alphabet soup of facilities like the TALF and the TAF and all of these other facilities that ultimately were the discount window brought to you, right, instead of people actually using it. So we actually just put out a note just about an hour ago talking about the fact that the usage of the discount window might show that there's a little less stigma today than there was in, say, 2007, when it probably should have been used the first time. And because of that, you know, there is this backstop for bank liquidity that hopefully will be used in times of need, not in times of, to try to avoid that crisis level that could potentially rear up. And there is risk here for sure. And that's one reason why I think people are still skittish about markets and why the Federal Reserve had to step in, create another new facility.
What's the new acronym, BTFP, or what is it?
Yeah, so it's the Bank Term Financing Program.
Okay.
So what that allows is for banks that own Treasury and agency securities to basically fund them for a year and not have to worry about whether or not they have to go into the open market to.
Well, the best part about that is they can do it at par, even if they're trading at 70 or 80 cents, right? You get 100.
Yeah, but
I mean, that's like a godsend. That's like a great free lunch, isn't it, Erica? These are mortgage-backed securities, right? So what are they trading at right now? If you go out, are some of them trading at a lot less than par?
Yeah, a lot of them are trading in the low to mid pars. Of course, you know, they're money good, so ultimately they're worth par, if you want to call it that. But right now, if you had to trade them on a mark-to-market basis because they were low coupon securities that were issued when rates were lower in 2021 and 2020, they are trading at a much lower dollar price because it's a lot lower coupon than you'd get for a current coupon today.
So, Eric, I know you got a note out, you know, calling out that the bank's mortgage-backed security demand
falling. You mean Ira?
No, I'm also talking to Erica.
Oh, thank Erica. You. Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Sorry.
So, Erica, talk to us about the bank's MBS demand here. What's going on in the marketplace?
Well, even prior to this current, what are we calling it, turmoil?
Turmoil, yeah.
This current turmoil, bank demand had been falling all year. Part of the reason that it's been falling is because their deposits have been falling. I think there's also, you know, lower reserves that they need to invest, want to invest. But mostly it's that their deposit base had been falling all year. It had risen sharply at the beginning of the pandemic as savings had risen and, you know, people had pandemic cash to spend. And then their securities holdings had gone up abruptly. Both of those have been declining as cash reserves and cash balances have been falling, cash deposits.
By the way, I thought you were, I didn't know you were going to Edelberg. I thought you were confusing Jersey with Kozatsky. You know, because a lot of times Eric Kozatsky joins us here on Munis, and it's kind of the same universe. But Jersey, let me ask you about what the Fed does in relation to what the ECB did. I was on the Ides of March, sitting at home in the throes of COVID hallucinations, reading Ben Emmons' note about the 2007-2008 parallels, and I was like literally terrified about what was happening. And then we got the news that the ECB raised rates 50 basis points, and I felt a real sigh of relief, because to me it's like, if they can raise rates in this environment, it must not be that bad. Is the Fed going to want to send some kind of similar message?
Well, I think they do, and that is that they're still in inflation fighting mode, right? And even if they do pause, I think what one of the things that they'll say is that they're not going to be cutting interest rates early, right? And I think that that's, you know, we went from pricing cuts this year to pricing no cuts, and now we're back to pricing a significant amount of cuts before year end. And I think if the Federal Reserve says, I think this is something, quite frankly, the Fed probably needed to do over the last two meetings, and say, these are the circumstances, these are the necessary but not sufficient conditions for what would make us cut interest rates. Number one is inflation is at, you know, this level.
Yep.
Number two is that, you know, the unemployment rate starts to go up, right? And those are, that's their mandates, right? And so you would need to have, you know, those necessary conditions in order for them to cut. Now, we kind of know that, but the Fed hasn't explicitly said it, so until they do, they won't. Going back to the funding programs, and I think this is the important thing, right? The central banks are the lender of last resort.
Right.
Not necessarily, you know, the arbiters of which institutions are supposed to survive, right?
Right.
So the thing is, when you have an issue where there's a bank with good assets, right? And this is the point here. If you have a bank with good assets,
we're just gonna have to leave it there because we have to.
But I get what you were saying, dude.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel Financial Advisors. If you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Tape. Catch our live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the TuneIn app, Bloomberg.com, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I want to get right to our next guest, David Dindy, CEO and co-founder of
Atomic Invest. All right, here's a dude. He gets his bachelor's in chemical engineering from Stanford. All right, so he's a geek in my mind immediately. Then he gets a master's in chemical and computational engineering. So this is a smart fella here. David, thanks so much for joining us. Can you first...
David Paul means that, by the way, in the best possible way.
I try to stay away from the numbers, David. Talk to us about Atomic Invest. What are you guys doing there?
We provide white-labeled wealth management and treasury services to banks, fintechs, and credit unions. So, for instance, if you have a fintech app that you work from or that you work with that is launching investing, we are in the background serving as the infrastructure partner as well as the regulated entity for them.
So that leads me, David, to the big question. If I am a startup that's just gotten a boatload of money from a VC and I put it all in a bank in Silicon Valley, suddenly last week I wanted to move it quickly to one of the big four Wall Street banks. Do you help me with that sort of thing?
Yes, and actually we helped hundreds of companies over the last 6 days do exactly that.
Wow.
Just share more context, part of our infrastructure also includes treasury management and the ability to open cash management accounts with banks and custodians like Bank of New York Mellon, who has entered into a strategic partnership with Atomic. And so we saw hundreds of such companies looking to open accounts with us and to transfer their assets into a place that they feel is safer.
Hey, David, here just in Wall Street in New York, we're all trying to get a sense of, is this systemic in the banking community or is it specific to the Bay Area, maybe some of those depositors and so on? What's the feeling out there in the Bay Area about how bad this is, how bad it could get? What's the feeling on the ground?
The feeling on the ground right now is that the recent collapse of SVB, Silvergate, and First Republic's precarious situation has emphasize the need for quality, resilience, stability, and corporate cash management. We've also seen that companies have now elevated corporate treasury management as something that needs to be a key competency that needs to be prioritized. And so I think many people right now, initially the first couple of days were a couple of days of panic, but over the last 2 or 3 days, people have been thinking more strategically in terms of how can they have an automated cash management solution that allows them to diversify strategically and to allocate their assets into treasury bills, as well as institutions that they feel are safe, like Atomic.
So you can help them manage their cash in ways that also provides returns. Right now, obviously, because rates are up. What about other kinds of problems, David? For example, the official limit on insurance is $250,000, but I'm sure that most of the companies you deal with need to have more cash on deposit than that just to operate simple things like payroll. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so most of the companies we deal with have tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in deposits. And so the typical FDIC insurance limit of 250K just doesn't make sense for them. And so for those companies, we sweep them into a money market sweep that offers up to $2.5 million of FDIC insurance through a multi-bank program. Mm. At the same time, we look to see what their liquidity needs are, as well as how much cash they have on hand, and structure custom ladders that allow them to put the cash that they might not need in the next month or two into treasuries, which, as we all understand, are fully backed by the U.S. government. That way, if a company has $50 million or $100 million, they can rest assured that their cash is either in these FDIC-insured sweeps or is in a security that is backed by the U.S. government in whole.
David, as founder and CEO of Atomic Invest, what have you done with your firm's cash?
We actually moved our firm's cash into our own platform prior to these events. We did have a relationship with SVB, and it's sad to see how things have unfolded. But right now, we manage our own cash on our own platform, custodied with Bank of New York Mellon Pershing. And we also...
No, go ahead, David. No, go ahead, please.
We also have our own ladder where we keep just a small amount of working capital in cash, and the rest of it is in treasury bills and money market funds.
So, David, as I understand it, one of the reasons that Silicon Valley Bank was created several decades ago was because small startup companies coming out of the valley, the
the big banks, the existing banks, would not bank them. Is that changed at all? I mean, if I take my money out of Silicon Valley Bank, am I not going to have the same problem?
I think the thing that is changing right now as we speak as a result of this dislocation is a model away from, you know, one bank banking all of the startups like a Silicon Valley Bank to a model where you have an infrastructure provider like Atomic that essentially allows companies to be able to access the services of these larger banks without having to contend with, you know, some of the limits or constraints that those larger banks might have in serving small companies. So I do think that the model will change drastically. I think that it's going to be fintech companies that offer these services to companies powered by infrastructure providers like Atomic in that respect. Happy to go into more detail.
Just speaking of detail, I got a question that's kind of in the weeds, but we had a story about depositors that moved their money out of SVB, but pick, you know, any bank that does that kind of business. They found out then, or they even knew before, that they had clauses where they weren't allowed to have access to certain loans if they didn't have, you know, specific deposit levels. And then now they're trying to deal with the legal morass of, do they put money back in, or how do you deal with that kind of issue?
Yeah, some of our clients have covenants that require them to keep their money with the specific bank where they've taken out a venture, where they've taken out venture debt from. And so we work with them to help them facilitate that. And there are programs that we're putting in place to actually provide the liquidity for those companies to pay out those loans. And we would take those loans instead, at least in a secured fashion in that respect.
David, thanks so much for joining us. Really fascinating story. It seems like you're right, and your company are right in the middle of it. David Dindy, CEO and co-founder of Atomic Invest, which is really interesting. They're out there in the valley, Matt, and you know, the one of these fintech stories that may become much more central to kind of how a lot of those companies do their banking.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fascinating. This is one of the companies that's, you know, on the ground, on the front lines, helping to move this money around, helping to work with these VCs that we talk about, you know, from this coast. Yep. In a kind of theoretical way, but they're actually doing the work with them and watching this, providing infrastructure and watching this money move around. So I think really cool to get in touch with David for a little bit.
Yeah, very interesting. And just getting a quick update on these markets, S&P down now 1.3%, kind of plumbing the bottoms of the intraday trading.
You're listening to The Team. Catch our live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a treat, folks. We get to speak with Ned Lamont, governor of the state of Connecticut. Governor Lamont, thanks so much for taking the time. The conversation here on Global Wall Street over the last 10 days has been, you know, kind of the concern we're seeing in the marketplace about some of these banks and what does that mean for the global economy. From the state of Connecticut, sir, how are you thinking about your state's economy, your state's soundness of the banking system? How are you thinking about those and how has that evolved over the last week or so?
Look, we watch this carefully. We're a small state. This is obviously a national issue. But this is Connecticut. We're the land of steady habits. I there's a little bit of the madness of crowds when you see everybody, running to the bank window to get their money out. And I'd like to think that we have we follow our banks very closely. We have a good, strong relationship there. We know what their asset base is, and we haven't seen any ripples. I do worry that it's going to make banks a lot more cautious around the country, and that could impact the economy.
Are the banks in Connecticut sound right now? You have full confidence in them?
I really do. You know, everything I've learned to understand, we have a strong economy. We have a diversified economy. Manufacturing, life sciences, they're all growing strong right now. I think that's reflected in the balance sheet of our banks.
Governor, one of the discussion points here is regulation, Dodd-Frank. Should the Dodd-Frank regulations, which really are, they were rolled back in 2018 to really just focus on some of the larger systemically important banks. But now we're seeing, geez, maybe some of these regional banks should have some more regulation. What's your opinion there?
I think they probably should. You know, the smaller banks are a lot more regional. The more regional have a sort of a customer base that's a little more narrow. Let's say Silicon Valley Bank was all the innovation and, you know, media type of investors. So I think you should keep a very close eye to make sure that their risk is diversified.
Yeah, Governor, I wanted to touch on an issue that we've heard a lot lately, ESG, et cetera, so forth. As far as underwriters for debt in certain states, the underwriters are being held to a new standard. Your view of that, and is it a disservice to the taxpayers?
The service to the taxpayers is that the banks are involved in their communities and making some you know, donations and contributions to our communities? I don't think so. I like the fact that the corporate community or the banking community is not an ivory tower. They're involved in their community. That's what community banking is. You know, you're first and foremost, you got to make sure you take care of your depositors and your shareholders. But I think they have a broader mission as well. So I think a lot of this ESG has been exaggerated.
Governor, what we saw during the pandemic, many things, one of the fallouts from it was a lot of people leaving the tri-state area and for many reasons, but many of them tax-related reasons. Talk to us about kind of how you think the tax situation is in Connecticut and maybe even the region, because if this region in Connecticut in particular wants to remain competitive, is there an argument that they need to be more competitive on a tax basis to something like a Florida, a Texas, some of those companies that seem to attract a lot of people and companies during the pandemic?
Well, first of all, during the pandemic, we probably had about 50, 60,000 families move into the state of Connecticut. Unfortunately for New York, a lot of them did come from New York, to your broader point. What I've got to do in Connecticut is make sure people know we have a stable fiscal situation, remind people that we're having the biggest tax cut in the history of the state is before the legislature right now. And for everybody earning less than $250,000, you know, you're paying probably less in Connecticut than you are in a lot of other states. We do have a progressive tax structure, so we make sure we keep an eye on that compared to other states, but that's not going up.
Hey, Governor, can we, those of us who live in high-tax states, expect to start deducting the full...
Oh, please.
You're getting everybody's blood boiling with this one, including Paul and myself. But with the state and local tax deductions, can we expect that to go back the way it was anytime soon? What's happening on that front?
Well, obviously, that's a federal determination. That was a tax increase on blue states up here in the Northeast. We got hit on that particularly hard because of our property and income tax and capping the deductibility. We put in place something called the pass-through entity credit. So at least for all those LLCs, we're able to hold them harmless, and it makes it a lot easier. They can deduct over on their balance sheet, even though if they can't do it personally. So we're trying to mitigate that effect as best we can.
Governor, one of the key issues for most states, certainly those in the Northeast, is transportation infrastructure. And just this week, Republican lawmakers in Connecticut legislature bypassed the Democratic majority to force a public hearing on a bill to eliminate the highway use tax. I know this is something is a tax that is a levy you've supported. What's going on in Connecticut with this issue?
The highway user fee, just like you have in New York, is paid disproportionately by a big tractor-trailer trucks that come right through our state. In many cases, we're just a pass-through state. They go up from Massachusetts to New York and beyond. They create a lot of wear and tear on our highways, so they are paying a mileage fee. You know, and over time, you're going to find the gasoline tax is less and less of a revenue driver as you move to all-electric vehicles. So I think this mileage fee, which you see on the tractor-trailers, is one more way we can diversify our revenue sources. Everybody thinks we're getting free money from the feds. Why do you need to be able to pay your own way? But the feds, you know, we got to pay 20 or 30%. A lot of those grants are competitive. So we got to show our ability to put up our share, but then we can leverage, thanks to the infrastructure bill, 3-1.
Yeah, you know, one of the issues we hear about every day, I mean, some of the people I work with, childcare, especially working moms, single working moms. What's the status of childcare in the state of Connecticut?
Interesting you ask. I'm here at a Beringer Ingelheim in Ridgefield. They've got a child care facility here, which we were celebrating. And so we have the biggest expansion of daycare child care in the history of the state. It gives the kids the very best head start. It allows mom and dad to get back to work. We have fewer people, you know, working. I've got to get them back off the sidelines into the game. And daycare child care is a big piece of that, making it accessible and making that affordable.
So what's the next step in Connecticut and for other states as well?
Well, for us, we're providing a 25% tax credit for new facilities, and for Beringer Ingelheim is subsidizing daycare for their workers here, and they've got a few thousand of them. We're providing a tax credit to help incent them to continue to do the right thing.
Governor, many parts of the country are dealing with an opioid crisis in their communities. Can you give us a sense of how the situation is in Connecticut, what the state is trying to do to combat it? Again, many parts of the country really, really getting ravaged by this.
I can tell you that coming out of COVID, the level of addiction and fatalities related to opioids, related to fentanyl, has been severe. And we've been addressing that in terms of you know, everything from mental health to Narcan and policing, going after those folks who are distributing. You know, sadly, fentanyl is just, it's everywhere right now, and it's so dangerous. So we're coming after that with law enforcement as well as treatment.
Well, what do the state's finances look like right now, as I imagine budget preparation is underway?
Yeah, we're pretty solid. We've got 15% set aside as a rainy day fund. Our revenues are holding up pretty well. Our income is up compared to last year. Capital gains is down a little bit, but we had anticipated that. And again, that allows us to have, you know, the biggest tax cut in the history of the state, which I think will be passed in the next 90 days.
Is there an appetite? I just want to get this one because I've asked this every governor I've talked to. Is there appetite in your state for anything like pension reform?
There's a lot of appetite. First of all, one of the things I've done is because we had a big unfunded pension liability. Nobody put money in the pension for the last 50 years. We paid down about $8 billion of pension debt in the last 4 years. That's not reform, but at least it's stabilizing what was a bleeding situation. And we're going to have to look more broadly at pension reform as the next budget, as the next employee contract negotiations come up over the next couple of years. We don't pay enough up front. We're having a hard time recruiting young employees, but there's a lot of big backside pension benefits that you get at a very early age. That's a less value when it comes to recruiting that 27-something who's thinking about where they want to go, the consulting firm or the Connecticut Department of Education. I want them at our DOE.
Hey, Governor, it's been about 20-year anniversary of the Iraq War, and it obviously impacted so many people here in this country and others. How did it impact you in your trajectory of your career?
Oh, big time. And I was I had a little telecommunications company, and we were wiring up big institutions, and I just thought the invasion of Iraq was a colossal error in judgment. We're going to be greeted as liberators. It's going to pay for itself. So I stood up. I challenged a guy named Joe Lieberman, who had been the Democratic candidate for vice president previously, and, in a primary here 20 years ago. And I think 20 years later, I think most people realize it was a terrible mistake, what it meant in terms of blood, what it meant in terms of treasure. Now, in hindsight, everybody was against the invasion of Iraq, but not at the time.
Governor, one of the issues here on Global Wall Street at Bloomberg Radio and Television, which we talk a lot about, just is kind of over the last week to 10 days with some of these banking issues, it just kind of brings to light the venture capital community. And I know you've had a business background. Your wife is in the venture capital business. How do you think that may be impacted going forward over the next several years?
how the banking crisis impacts investment capital and
venture capital and just, you know, kind of growth capital for new technologies and so on?
Well, I'd pull the lens back, first of all. I think one of the greatest strategic advantages this country has is a liquid capital market, and that starts with investment capital. That starts with the venture capital, in particular seed capital, which is what we're doing in this state. We've had more new business startups the last 3 years than we had in the last 23 years combined. So I really worry about the risk appetite pulling back, and part of that's reflected in the nervousness in and around our banking system. I'll leave it at that.
Hey, Governor, you want to make some predictions for the presidential race? who you support? Should Joe Biden run again? And who do you think the Republican nominee will eventually be?
If I had to guess right now, I think it will be Biden versus Trump. But, you know, I probably said it's going to be Clinton versus Bush 8 years ago. So I'm not very original on that. But more importantly, which of you is the big Duke supporter in basketball?
So just,
you don't want to run into the UConn Huskies.
That's where I wanted to go.
That's the prediction I will make.
Well, I want a prediction here because you have a great coach there in Danny Hurley. He's a New Jersey product, comes from the great Hurley family coaching tree, and his brother's also coaching in the NCAA tournament at Arizona State. Of course, his father, Bob Hurley, is a legendary high school coach from St. Anthony's in Jersey City. So talk to us about your UConn Huskies here.
He's done an amazing job. The men's basketball team wasn't winning there for a little while, having had a great tradition under Jim Calhoun. They've got 5 years of improvement. I think they're one of the certainly top 10 teams in the country. They're playing really well. And we got a guy named Gino Auriemma on the other side when it comes to women's basketball. They're going to be going to the Final Four.
Very good. Ned Lamont, best of luck to the UConn Huskies there. Love to see that program get back to where it was.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Tape. Catch our live program, Bloomberg Markets, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the TuneIn app, Bloomberg.com, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
FedEx reported numbers last night, and to my untrained eye, they missed numbers, but the stock is up. So this is a story, it sounds like, cost-cutting. And cost-cutting is certainly in vogue for many companies in many different industries these days. You don't have to be just a startup company. You could be a company like FedEx. Lee Klaskow, he's a sector head, senior analyst. He covers all the freight, transportation, and logistics for Bloomberg Intelligence. Lee, FedEx stock, it's up 8.2% today. What did the street like?
Yeah, I think, you know, FedEx has been a company in transition, and it's kind of been a while. Like, people are really expecting them to execute. And what it seems like is management is finally executing. You know, FedEx is probably late to the game in terms of aligning its resources to demand. You know, UPS is kind of was doing that a couple of years ago. But it looks like some of the cost-cutting measures that they've been doing have really started to work. You know, they beat expectations by 70 cents a share. Their earnings in their fiscal third quarter came in at $3.41, which was 70 cents above expectations. And that was really, you know, to your point, being driven on the cost-cutting side, especially in its ground business and its freight business, which is its less-than-truckload business. And they also guided up. So they raised full-year guidance. So it was implied EPS for the fourth quarter, their fiscal fourth quarter, of $4.57 to $5.17, which was well above consensus of $4.23. So, you know, people are recalibrating their expectations for the fourth quarter, and I think they're recalibrating their expectations for fiscal 2024. For FedEx. So, you know, I think you're going to see earnings estimates from the street move higher in the coming days and weeks.
Okay, when you cut costs, are you cutting into future growth? I mean, is this sort of a Faustian bargain for some companies?
No, not really. So they're doing some, like, temporary cuts, which is, you know, really dealing with the demand trends. So maybe, like, cutting some flights, parking some airlines, you know, things that when demand picks up, they can easily get back into business. And they're also, you know, FedEx has always been considered a little more bloated than some other companies, and I think they're just dealing with that bloat. You know, they announced a bunch of, you know, middle management and senior management cuts, which they're doing across the organization. They're talking about, you know, they operate two very separate networks. They operate a ground network and an express network, which is unique because, you know, most companies in the courier business, they'll have one network. So UPS, their express and their domestic business is kind of all in one operation. And, you know, FedEx is looking at ways at where they can combine those two networks, you know, and gain kind of some of the scale and benefit that will bring and just increase productivity overall. Because at the end of the day, you know, these networks were built for B2C commerce and as B2B, I'm sorry, they're built for B2B commerce. And as, you know, business to consumer commerce or e-commerce is picking up, you know, they need to kind of change the way these asset intensive networks operate.
That's kind of where I wanted to go, Lee, as I think about FedEx and UPS and DHL and boy, even Amazon. How have the businesses changed since the pandemic? It just seems like, is there more capacity in the system now? Is the demand going to grow from this higher level? How has it changed?
Yeah, so I mean, if you want to talk about like pre-pandemic to today, so obviously, you know, we had a surge in, you know, B2C or e-commerce demand as more and more people were, you know, stuck at home and not able to get out. You know, that pulled forward e-commerce penetration by 3 to 5 years. And so what that did was that really brought a rush into this lower margin business into their network. So if you think about it, you know, when you see a FedEx delivery person come into your house and delivering one package, you know, the margins on that's pretty small relative to them going to a lawyer's office and delivering 100 packages. So what they're trying to do is build denser networks to be able to, you know, lower their cost to deliver. So, you know, in addition to your questions about what's different, you know, obviously we had, you know, very tight labor markets. Those labor markets are loosening a little bit. You know, it's a lot easier to find people today than it was a year ago. That's, you know, some less pressures that they're facing. But in generally speaking, you know, they just have, not necessarily reinvent themselves, but just take a look at their networks and figure out, you know, how should they be operating with this new paradigm of, you know, more home deliveries versus, you know, B2B deliveries.
What counts for innovation in this industry?
So there's a lot of things. So there's software. So the tracking tracing technologies, they're always constantly improving that. They're trying to figure better ways to route freight. They're making big investments in automation. So they're trying to get more of their sorting hubs automated. So more and more of their freight doesn't really get touched by people. And if it is touched by people, they charge a surcharge for that. And that was really, you know, one of the things coming off the call last night.
was that, you know, pricing remains rational across all of its businesses, which is really good. You know, they still can get price increases even if volumes are declining in some of their businesses by mid to high single digits. So, you know, they'll be able to offset that. You know, their earnings, you know, were down by, you know, significant double digits versus last year. Obviously, you know, last year was an unsustainable level, but their revenue was only off by, you know, like low single digits. So,
right.
You know, you're still seeing them able to price in this difficult market.
Hey, Lee, 30 seconds. You cover everything on the logistics front. Is the supply chain fixed?
The supply chain will never be fixed because it's always changing and always complicated. But the good news is that, you know, there was a lot of news last year and about, you know, the backup at the ports. Well, there hasn't been a backup at the ports for quite some time, since November. So that's good news. You know, the next wrench in the system could be a strike at, you know, FedEx's big competitor, UPS. Their contract ends at the end of July. That actually might be a near-term benefit for FedEx as shippers look to secure capacity ahead of the uncertainty. You know, we think there, you know, is a low probability of a strike. You know,
okay.
we don't think it's going to happen. But, you know, shippers have to prepare. We were at a conference this week,
right,
talking to a bunch of shippers. And they were telling us, you know, that they're engaging with other providers to make sure their stuff gets to where it needs to be.
All right, I got it. Good stuff, Lee. Sector head, he covers all things logistics for Bloomberg Intelligence.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.